This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
We're going to dig into a conversation about the Sandra Birchmore case with Robin Dreek here in just a second. But let me give you a little background on the case in case you're new to this one as it's reemerging from the background as we get closer and closer to a trial date and what's going to happen. Sandra Birchmore was 23, pregnant, and found dead near her apartment in 2021. A death originally labeled a suicide by local police, local Stoughton police, by the way. Actually, Canton police. He was originally a Stoughton officer. I got to get this. There's all these different moving parts here. Prosecutors now say he was murdered by Stoughton police officer Matthew Farwell, who had groomed and exploited her for years after meeting her as a child in the department's Explorer program. Farwell is now federally indicted for her death, accused of strangling Sandra and staging the scene to cover up a long pattern of abuse. But the rot goes deeper. Multiple officers were entangled in Sandra's life, and yes, sexually. Yet most simply resigned, faced no charges, and disappeared from accountability. This case isn't just about one predator. It's about an entire system that looked the other way. And today, we're joined by Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent and behavioral expert, to break down how this abuse was allowed to happen, how predators use authority to control their victims, and what we as a society miss when institutional power masks itself as protection. Let's just kind of start here. It started with a badge. It started with an Explorer program, and it started with a 13-year-old girl. How does this thing end up with her pregnant and her dead and him being charged with murder? How do we go from that to that? I know it's a huge, wide question, but let's start with the beginning. What the heck do you think happened here? And how did this officer somehow decide that I'm gonna go after the 13-year-old?
Yeah, I think it's a clear case, again, innocent until proven guilty, of just using a position of power and authority to gratify his sexual needs. I think it's just purely that control, sex, and just abusing someone who's vulnerable. And they're using the platform of the Explorer program, which is a great idea, great concept, when it's executed well by healthy individuals that are going to be put into those places of authority to interact with youth who are at a critical stage of development in their lives. They're looking for stability. They're looking for safety. They're looking for structure. They're looking for a path forward in life to do something exciting, do something of service. And this one individual destroyed that.
Completely. It's one of those things where we're looking at this going, okay, Farwell is arrested. He's been charged. He's the one who we know had relations with her before she was 18, starting at 15. There's some other officers who have not been charged with anything because they allegedly, as far as we know, were having relations with her after she turned 18. So it was technically legal. But you look at the system and these guys, a lot of them knew her well before that. You have a school resource officer being one of them. You have his brother being one of them. And God knows who else, who we don't know about, that was one of them. And they all silently just kind of, you know, drifted off into the ether. One resigned, I think they both resigned from their positions and just kind of, or one of them also let their credentials lapse in terms of being renewed. And now they're just out there, not saying a word about it. Technically, what they did, as long as it was after they were 18 and it was consensual, was legal under the eyes of the law. But the creepy, creepy factor of this here is it seems like a lot of these guys were looking at her in this Explorer program when she was a child and then ended up going, obviously, much further when she became an adult. Is there... Unless you can prove that they did anything with her under the age of 18, is there any recourse for this? Is there anything that these guys can be charged with? Or is it just it's kind of a sick thing. It's just a sick demonstration of behavior. There's always creepy guys out there that go after women that are far too young for them. But this one just has a different layer of darkness to it.
Yeah, I don't know about the legal aspect of it, whether they can still go after him or not, especially if she's of legal age. I'm not thinking so. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about that layer of creepiness too, you know, I want to first caveat that the very vast majority of law enforcement doesn't do this.
Sure.
But there are cases. As a matter of fact, I personally know of cases in law enforcement and in departments where, unfortunately, you have a very, very male-dominated environment, and they will prey on women, and they will. It sound crass. They'll pass them around sometimes.
God.
You know, where someone comes in with a reputation, whether it's another law enforcement officer themselves or someone affiliated with the department in some way, and gets a reputation, and these creepy degenerates will pass these women around, and it's a cabal of unhealthy, crazy, narcissistic self-gratification behavior by everyone involved. They prey on someone who's vulnerable psychologically, and then they're going to just do these horrendous things. And I'm at a loss for words most times when thinking about how deplorable it is.
Yeah. When the whispers started about Farwell's illicit relationship with Sandra, there was no internal investigation. Instead, those that were aware, like other officers, quietly blew out the candle. Some left the department, mm-hmm. others let certifications lap. That culture of silence helped bury the case until federal agents intervened years later. Is this something, I mean, it's just pure speculation here, but when you have a department that's cool enough to, and I'm not saying cool enough in a good way, I'm saying in their own weird way of thinking, well, we're going to kind of let you pass over here. But they're, I guess, chill enough that they don't go and investigate this. They don't raise a red flag. They don't go, that none of this is okay. You can't just, you know, disappear from this. That's a culture. That's not just one person that's trying to slowly mm-hmm. slip into the silence. That's other people going, okay, well, let you pass. What does that say? Does that mean other people could be involved in this that we don't know about? Does that just say, look, I got your back here because you got my back there? I mean, it's obviously there's that solid line of blue that can exist in some departments. What do you think is happening here? I mean, this is a department. It's Canton PD. Again, we're back in near Karen land.
Yes.
And this is what a lot of people had issues with in the Karen trial. They would look at this. They were trying to even bring some of this evidence into the trial, but they did not, of showing a pattern of bad behavior, of covering things up. And this is not the Karen Reed case. And I think the two stand very differently on their own. But again, we got that culture going on where things kind of, you know, we can do weird things and nobody's going to question us. What are your thoughts on how this is working out over there and what needs to change if it hasn't already?
So here's what's going on behaviorally. Anytime we see horrendous, chaotic things, we just got to slow down. We'll break it down behaviorally and take a look. So first, let's go back to motivations of all human beings that are designated Homo sapiens, us. We are genetically and biologically coded to act in our own best interests in terms of our safety, security, and prosperity, according to what we think that is. We're always going to act in terms of our safety. And so if we're looking at people's actions, we always have to then assess and assume that the actions they're taking are actions they're taking that they think from their perspective, from their context, using that deep empathy we talk about, in other words, walk in their shoes. They're acting in their best interest and what they think is going to keep them safe. So when people are acting outside of the norms of standard human behavior and ethically and morally, that means that there's a lever of influence over them of fear, because people will act and take actions based on fear. So in situations like this, where people are doing these sorts of actions, getting away with these sorts of actions, and then moving away from, in these cases, like silently trying to resign and get out, there's at least one individual from a higher point that has a lever of fear over people that are going to speak out. And so anytime I see situations like this, I'm going to start poking and looking and examining who is in a position of influence over everyone else that can use a lever of fear for people underneath. And so that's where I'm looking first. And so it comes down to me, the greatest things you can do in a situation like this is who's leading, because it's that leadership someplace. And it could be a position of title and authority, or it could be just a position of influence because of that personality trait that it puts them in that position that gives them that lever of fear over others.
Do you think Sandra Birchmore feared Matthew Farwell, or do you think she loved him? Do you think it was, maybe there's fear in there, but her definition of it was not fear, it was love, because of the grooming at such a very young age. And that reality, fear versus love, was maybe flipped in her mind. Or maybe there was no fear at all. I mean, she was, in her mind, in a relationship, in her mind, she was pregnant with his kid. They had been together since she was 15. She was in her early 20s at this point. So we're talking fairly long-term relationship, granted completely age inappropriate, and the whole damn thing is inappropriate, but she did become an adult halfway through that. Do you think she suspected for 1 second that Farwell would do this to her? Do you think she just had such an undying trust because she was coming from a rough life and he demonstrated that he cared about her? At least she perceived that. Obviously, it was not that. But she perceived that she was in a trustworthy situation. She had other officers that she had been with as well. Also, I think she's probably putting him into that safe category. Do you think in her mind she was sitting there surrounded by some of the safest people she could be with? Well, in reality, she was surrounded by predators and couldn't see it.
We'll put our conjecture hat on because we don't know her. Yeah. If, man, Tony, this is one of those cases kind of like Maddie Soto, where you kind of sit here and you listen to the facts and data and you just want to cry. Mm-hmm. This little girl was so abused and so groomed. It was sickening. From her point of view, you know, I researched this again before we got into this, because I really wanted to do a deeper dive on this. You know, people will gravitate towards law enforcement and great programs like this because they are looking for doing things of consequence, being a service to others. I mean, Grant, it's funny. I've done a lot of psychological fun testings, whether it's the five-factor model, the DISC, or the Myers-Briggs, or all these things for law enforcement and military in general. And people would think that law enforcement and military have these high dominant personalities, very controlling and just like this. Believe it or not, most people that go into law enforcement very much like people when they go into nursing or being doctors or service, they're very, very service compassionate individuals that want to be of service to others. And so it can be a very gravitating energy sump for people that want to do that, be of service to others, which I think it made it easy for her to want to become part of the Explorer program, which is, again, a great program that helps people get established. It helps people, you know, see a future ahead and also feel safe, like we said, because people also gravitate towards law enforcement and jobs like this because there's structure, there's organization, there's people that are wearing uniforms, there's codes of conduct, there's ethics, there's morals. And so if you're coming from a background of feeling insecure, unsafe, you're insecure about yourself, and you're not being validated properly by the friends and family in your life, or you don't have any, this will offer that structure that helps people feel that way. And then the critical thing goes sideways when a department does not select their good people to run those programs. You know, what being from the background of both military and law enforcement, or you're always undermanned, you're always understaffed, you don't have enough resources, you have all these demands pressed upon you for operational type things, you typically take your best people and you place them in ops, operations, you know, out there, investigators, street cops, sergeants, lieutenants that are doing the high risk operations that are protecting the public safety. And so what happens sometimes is they'll take someone with not the same kind of morals, ethics, and credibility, maybe, or someone's been shoved aside, or someone that's not appropriate for a job like this, and they'll put them in a job like this. So not prioritizing this type of program, which is the future of the department, the future of keeping public safety at the level it should be, and they're placing them in these positions, which is exactly what I think happened here. Is you take someone with a shady, horrible internal structure, and you place them in charge of youth, and it's a recipe for this.
Yeah, I mean, what a crazy recipe it is. Why do you think it is that no one said anything? Do you think no one noticed anything when they were together when she was younger? I mean, allegedly the sexual encounters started when she was 15. They met at 13. Are people looking the other way? Were other officers looking the other way? We're talking, you know, she was a kid, so she's telling her friends and stuff about this. Two very different perspectives, I would imagine, from two very different groups of people, other 15-year-olds. I mean, I remember being 15, and I remember some of the girls that back then talking about their boyfriends that were in their 20s, and they kind of had it normalized in their mind, even at that age in the 90s. A lot of us were like, that's weird, but nobody would say anything. It was just like, oh, well, it's what you do. I mean, I can certainly give a pass to other 15-year-olds. They're 15. They're young and dumb. Everyone is at that age. But the other adults, how? Why? I mean, what? Why would you not say something unless you had some sort of intention of, well, maybe there's room for me in this relationship too? And the sick part is it really feels like that's what the thought process was from some of these people.
I think there's going to be multiples here. There's a fear factor, like I mentioned earlier, fear of saying something where it's going to jeopardize your prosperity, your job, your standing with the community and your family and all those things. So there's a fear factor in there because the person that is actually doing these actions has that lever of fear over you for some reason, somehow. And so that's one thing. Not wanting to change things. Human beings do not like change. And so we will rationalize behaviors that we're observing and seeing to not tip the apple cart, to not change things. So that's also part of it. And then the normalization of the behavior, hey, if you came in, you're new to the department, he's been in charge of this program for a long time, you kind of see a few things that are off and you mention it to someone else, oh no, it's okay. He's been doing this way the entire time. So it's rationalized behavior from a groupthink mentality. And so it's been socialized norm that way. And then you have the victim themselves that are saying they like the attention or they seem to be acting fine. Because what happens is if you see inappropriate behavior and you're new to the department or you're afraid to speak out, the next thing you're going to do is not just on the perpetrator of the horrendous action, you're going to look at the victim. How's the victim acting? Is she smiling? Is she happy? Are things seeming copacetic? Are people around her seeing that? So you're going to, because what are you looking for? You're looking for your own confirmation bias that everything's okay, so I don't have to tip the apple cart and make my life unsafe. And so all those factors come into play here.
Obviously, it was a staged suicide, allegedly, mm-hmm. That was what they found. These are, you know, somewhat seasoned investigators who went in and looked at it and still said, yep, it's a suicide, despite when you look at the actual evidence, it doesn't appear to be a suicide. Do you think the investigators are just incompetent, didn't like doing deep investigations, didn't want to dig a little bit deeper for fear of what they might find? Why do you think it took years and it took the FBI to get involved to look at everything and go, wait a second, why on earth would you guys think this was a suicide? That's got to be a weird moment when you're coming in from a federal level to the local level going, what the hell were you guys thinking? I mean, that's I think red flags would go everywhere at that moment in time if you were overlooking that, wouldn't it?
For all the reasons we just said.
Yeah.
Affirmation bias. They want to prove what they want to believe, and yeah, there you go. And no one, and there was fear as well as the confidence that no one's going to question them. Because what did they lack? The same thing we've said numerous times on so many cases. No loving critic. You know, so the FBI comes in as a loving critic. Hey, we love our law enforcement brethren here. We want to support them. But the critic says, but this is off. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing that this strikes me of, you know, when you talk about this blue wall of silence or this group tribe mentality, when I was in the Marine Corps, we had a saying that I hold very true, and that is mission first, people always. And when I came into the Bureau from the FBI, from the Marine Corps, that held true when working confidential human sources or even working with colleagues. You work so closely with individuals that they become your brothers and sisters, that you are joined in arms to do the righteous work out there. You support each other to all ends of the earth. I mean, I was in 9/11 in New York City, doing that deep, deep work with a lot of these partners, both inside the Bureau, outside the Bureau. I mean, it was everyone in the world, my confident human sources. But at the end of the day, if they were acting morally and ethically wrong, I'd be the first to turn them in. Mm-hmm. Because you have this personal closeness, but a professional film that must be maintained. It was the first thing I was trained on with working with competent human sources in the FBI was this relationship. It was easy for me to understand because when I was in the Marine Corps, I was an officer and I worked with my staff NCOs, my enlisted. We were close. We were bonded. I couldn't do anything without them. They were the ones in charge of training me as a young officer. But at the same time, I was doing making the calls for everything because I was responsible for all these things. And I would do all I could to make sure they had a prosperous, successful career, and they went home at the end of the day safely to their families. But if one of them went sideways, went bad, I'd be the first that had to hammer them. Mm-hmm. That was my responsibility as a leader because we maintain these morals and ethics. So we can do the most important thing. Have the public safety at the forefront of our minds, and we only do that when the public has trust and reliance on us as organizations, institutions. With one person blowing that, the reason we do what we do completely goes out the window. And so it's mission first, people always. Mm-hmm. And have to be able to realize when you actually have to go at the people because it's compromising the mission. And you're going to go at them in a way that it's not a witch hunt. It's a, hey, we catch things early to prevent it from cascading down the line. There's been a few times in my own career where I was a gray line kind of guy. I'm an operations guy. I love doing righteous work. And there was rules and regulations we had to do inside the FBI. I knew exactly where that gray line was. And I loved to ride it to try to do the stuff that was so important, not for personal gain, but for, again, the righteous work to protect the country. And I remember I'd come up with some crazy ideas sometimes. And before I execute them, I'd share them with a friend or a colleague. And the first question my loving critic would always say to me, did you tell the supervisor this? I go, ah. I said, then you're not supposed to do it. Because if you fear transparency of your actions, it's not a righteous action. And so from this point of view, the first thing a groomer will do that is testing the waters, they're going to try to have a secret communication, a covert communication with a potential victim. In this case, I guarantee you, with a high probability that when Farwell was starting to groom her, he started off by a glance, a smile, a wink, a nod, a text message maybe, a conversation away from everyone else where he gives her some sort of validation that's not known by everyone else. There's a lack of transparency. Mm-hmm. And he's testing, is she going to share that? And so now you do that once, and now when you're sitting in a classroom and you get together with all the other explorers, he's given a briefing, given things, and all of a sudden, they take a break. And who's he go to? Who's he got a little secret conversation with over the side? And so this is what builds over the time. It makes her feel special. Mm-hmm. The one thing that she wanted to do in life was feel special, part of something bigger than herself, part of a group and being accepted and valued for who she is. That's how these groomers do it. And so in that one first action, he either should have been called out by someone observing if they had what we call TPI, two-person integrity, with what you're doing, journaling and writing a logbook at the end of the day, all the contacts you had with all the students and what the results was, and then signed off by everyone, something. And most importantly, him. Is this the conversation I'd be willing to share with my colleagues, with my boss, with my supervisor who is emotionally detached, who's my objective loving critic? If that answer is no, then that's what you shouldn't be doing. That's why we need those loving critics at the lowest level before it even starts. And he didn't have it. No one there in the department had it. And it spirals out of this control.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a monologue. Really. Sorry.
No. I mean, you're dead on. Let me ask you this about it. and it's something I hear a lot of people like in the corporate world talking about, and it seems to be very similar to what you're talking about. Bosses, managers, owners, whatever, they will be the first, the good, successful ones that I look to and I follow. They'll be the first to get rid of a horrible person, even if they are a great employee, even if they, they bring a lot to the company, they're super skilled at whatever the hell they're doing, whatever the goal of that company is, they're very good at that. But in their personal life, they're cheating on their wife, they're a shitty person this way. There's all these different things that are not connected to the work world, but you learn about as you get to know them more, and you're like, holy shit. That's something that, and it's got to be difficult to get rid of those people, especially when you're in a situation where you don't have a lot of replacements coming in. And law enforcement certainly is one of those places where, you know, you gotta, it's not like there's just this waiting line to get in. There's it takes a lot of work to get somebody in and to get good quality people in. So sometimes you're probably stuck between a rock and a hard place if you're a manager of this and you're overseeing all of your staff and your officers and going, well, I need somebody over here. I mean, that's a huge thing. What do you say to someone or a department that's in that sort of situation where it's hard to get people in? Here's what we got. Get rid of them regardless. I mean, how do you handle something like that? Because it sounds like this place kind of got overrun with a handful of them.
I totally agree, and it's the most greatest challenge that most organizations have, especially in law enforcement these days, because you don't have the personnel to maintain. I used to do a lot of training for the leadership academies across Virginia and across the country for law enforcement, and I would talk to chiefs, and some of these chiefs were chiefs of departments of like 8 sworn, only 8 officers for a small little town, and yet they were mandated by their town council. They had to maintain 24/7 coverage availability for the town, and this one chief told me he had a horrible officer that was had all these complaints against him for abuse and for pulling people over and just being verbally offensive, and yet he's mandated by the town council that he has to maintain this thing, and he couldn't get a replacement. So I understand this rock in a hard place. At a certain point, you just have to be able to either put that accountability in there, put that training in there, or get rid of the program. Like in this case, so you know, we'll put our hindsight's 2020 on. You know, here I am, the chief of this department, and I know I placed this officer or an officer like this in this position of the explorers because the town council or someone says I have to have the explorer program. It's part of our funding if we don't have this program. And I need all these other officers that are doing a good job, and we're understaffed out on the street doing X, Y, and Z because that's where our stats are also measured at, and I got to manage his personnel. I either got to be able to put in accountability, lever over him that's running this Explorer program, or I got to cut the program and just face the heat on it. And here's the key challenge that I faced in law enforcement, and I had to teach people how to overcome. When you're dealing with human behavior, people have a hard time quantifying objectively that measure. And that makes it hard to justify not doing something because they say, well, just be better. Just do it better. Just lead better. That's not an answer. Yeah. You need to be able to quantify. And so when I was working with a competent human source that didn't quite reach the level of where my bosses thought they should be, or the number of meetings it's taken to get them there, I had to be able to say, listen, here's the exact specific taskings we covered at this meeting. Here's where they fell short on those taskings. Here's what we're going to cover next time. Here's the measure we're putting in place to measure that progress. If they fall short of this, then this. In other words, you have to be able to take a subjective art form of human behavior and make it objectable by asking what questions, quote unquote, what, so it makes people be very specific, makes it measurable, makes it actionable, and makes it progressive. And if you can't do that, then here we're going to have a different conversation. If you can't articulate that to a town council, if you can't articulate that to investigators, if you can't articulate that to the public in general, then you're doing it wrong. You just got to be able to do that. And so that's what people are looking for when you're doing anything in briefings. They're looking for measurable actions that people can measure.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you have someone on board like that in a law enforcement capacity, you're facing the risk of, you know, what are they going to do to the citizens out there? What could possibly happen that could go horribly wrong there beyond just the complaints of he's rude, he's an ass, all that stuff? You're also, I would imagine, risking having that person in that circle, especially if it's a smaller department, of you got a bad apple in there. And sometimes those bad apples bring out the worst in other people, things that you may not see if that bad apple wasn't in there. It's like a cancer, how it will spread out and then sometimes slowly infect others and get them to participate in the same bad acts that maybe they wouldn't have on their own. Do you think that that could be what has happened here? Or maybe we just have a whole bunch of bad apples that all just happen to end up in the same barrel?
There's bad apples everywhere in life. Doesn't matter what the profession is, doesn't matter anything. I have never been part of any situation or studied anything that situations like this were not prevented with solid leadership. Mm-hmm. Solid leadership meaning that it takes time and energy and resources to be a good leader. And when you start seeing this, again, we'll go back to one of the other key themes that you and I keep hitting on in all these different cases. It's secret place. If I can't account for your time, then you're not being transparent with your time. I need to know what you're doing, when you're doing it, and how you're doing it. I'm not micromanaging you. I'm supervising you. I'm looking for accountability of what you're doing. And if I can't figure that out, it's on me. These are, in every single case where we're seeing things like this go sideways, lazy leadership that lacks the courage to have a tough conversation with someone who needs to have a tough conversation. That's exactly it. I have never seen a situation with a solid leader that this thing didn't get resolved. I mean, you just gave a great example in the corporate world, Tony, and that is a good, strong leader will make the tough decision for someone that knows how to flip that switch really well. But this person can flip that switch better than anyone else. Their productivity in their specific little thing like this is solid, but their life around there is an unhealthy disaster. I guarantee you over time, that's going to have leakage into their ability to flip that switch and the toxicity of everyone around them. Cut it out now and teach someone else to flip that switch, because it's easier to teach someone to flip a switch than to be a human being that is healthy.
Let me ask you this, though. I mean, can a good leader always get through to people like, allegedly, like Matthew Farwell? Obviously, if he's already committed the crime, he's got to go if you find that out. But if he hasn't, if it's just, you know, I think you're being a little too flirty with that young lady over there. I mean, can a good leader fix someone like that? Or does the good leader just have to get rid of somebody like that? But then you run into the problem where you have so many protections for some people. But police are incredibly protected. It takes a lot to get somebody fired. It takes a lot. And it doesn't just take that leader going, you got to go. It's going to go through a lot more than just that. So in some ways, you have hands tied here. You have a lot of push just to keep people on and get them in the right direction. Is that an area where we need to look a little closer at? We seem to have a lot of systems in place to protect people or people that, and for good people really is why it's designed, but bad people end up falling into it. They end up being able to check the boxes and falling into the category of good luck getting rid of me. Do we need less protections so bad people can be removed by good people when they are found out? Because it seems the ball is in their court and the rights are on the bad people's side versus the good people when they finally get found out.
Yeah, it's a challenge and a problem. But I'm going to share something I learned when I was 24 years old. I mean, a young guy, young officer in the Marine Corps, that was the most effective tool that's been with me my entire life. And first of all, it goes to the adage, if you didn't write it, it didn't happen. Document, 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 document. It seems like it's a bean pusher kind of thing, but I'm telling you that will counter anything that there's a protection for the bad officer. Mm-hmm. Documentation, number one. And here's how you document. And this requires energy. It requires bravery. And when I was 24 years old, doing this to my staff NCOs that were twice my age with four times as much experience, it took some courage. But I would observe a behavior. So let's superimpose on this case. Mm-hmm. So in the Marine Corps, if I saw one of my people doing something that was off, I'd have to counsel them. I had mandatory weekly counseling of all my Marines. And in these counselings, I would either say, hey, we're good to go, two thumbs up. Or if I saw something was off, I was mandated. I had to write a paragraph, write it out. Here's what I observed your actual specific behavior was. Not hearsay. Here's what I myself observed. Now, if I heard rumor of something from someone, some third party thing, I can't go on hearsay. So what's it make me do as a leader? I got to be present. Mm-hmm. I got to be here. I got to be witness. And if I'm here witnessing, it'll deter your bad behavior. Now, granted, this takes time and energy. Fixing problem people, and some are not fixable, Tony. That's mm-hmm. why we have to get rid of them. We can only get rid of them with documentation. Requires me to be present. The hours I put in as a leader, I was insurmountable. But if you don't want to lead, don't do it. Mm-hmm. Don't put in for it, because this takes time and energy. Because when you go into leadership, it's not about you. It's about your people. It's you being there for their success. Anyway, I had a document. I had to observe it specifically. And so I'd write down what I specifically saw myself in a paragraph. I then would sit down with my Marine, with my law enforcement officer. So in this case, if I saw this individual having so here's what I pick up right away. I'm sitting in the back of a classroom, or I'm sitting at an event where there's an Explorer event. And I saw Officer Farwell having a conversation after the class, or even making a focused attention on a specific individual or student in the class. I would go up to that individual at the end. I say, hey, tell me about so-and-so. And I would let them know, hey, I'm seeing a behavior here that's a little off. And I'd be there again next time. And if I saw a conversation off to the side, if I saw a special attention, I would then write this down. Listen, we are not supposed to have individual relationships with these students. Everyone's supposed to be treated equal. I personally am seeing something a little off here. If I'm seeing something off, other people are seeing this off. That comes down under the category of professionalism. Mm-hmm. Professional people do not have specific personal relationships with students at large. So here's what I'm seeing. Here's what I need to observe you doing. I don't want to see this kind of thing again. I sign this. You sign this. If I see this again, we're going to have a different conversation about your career. Mm-hmm. If I don't see it again in another month, then I'm going to give you this piece of paper back, and no harm, no foul. Mm-hmm. That's how we correct behavior. I see it, I address it, and it's not what I'm saying. I am observing this. This is your action. This is completely on you about how to rectify this. And if you don't want to rectify this behavior, that's fine. I'm going to help you find something else, because it ain't going to be this. And so that's what is lacking here. Well, it's that specific way of doing it, but that's why I had to do it. That's what I learned to do it. And this isn't about... these aren't challenging conversations. This is a conversation about you and what you're doing. I am here for your success. You are not going to be successful in this position because you're observing a bias towards an individual for whatever reason it is. And it could be a male student. It could be someone that they have a personal attention to or emotionally attached to someone, a family member. I don't care what it is. But there's a perception from everyone involved in a situation of special treatment. That erodes morale, that erodes ethics, morals, the whole thing goes out the window. You cannot do that, but you need to be present. Someone needs to be present to do that for the accountability.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.